Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Adloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief, as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey Griefsters, I hope you're having an okay week. I'm recording this extremely late because, just for update, she's sleeping, guys, my child, if you listened to last week's intro, but now I've got loads of work to catch up on and I have to do it late at night. What have I been doing? I can also recommend watching this season of RuPaul's Drag Race if you don't already. It's so good, guys. It's nothing about grief, but start lighting the mood. Also, we have a live Griefcast come up. That's actually genuine information for you. June 6th, I'm going to be joined by Jeff Lloyd, Josie Long, and Camille Yucan as well. All amazing podcasters and comedians in their own right at the Underbelly Festival on the South Bank. You can head to their website for tickets, or I've been tweeting tickets as well. Do make sure you're following us on at the Griefcast. This week's guest is writer Emma McGlycett. Emma is the author of two incredibly funny, brilliant best-selling books with her longtime friend and collaborator, Sarah Breen. They've been hailed as Ireland's answer to Bridget Jones. Oh My God, What a Complete Aisling, and the follow-up, The Importance of Being Aisling, are available to buy in paperback now. Emma came in to talk to me about her dad. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm here today with Emma McGlycett, who is one of the authors of the incredibly successful Oh My God, What a Complete Aisling, and the new book, which is coming out very shortly, which is The Importance of Being Aisling. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Emma, this book has like an amazing back history, doesn't it? Which, of like how it became a book. What, do you mind, if people haven't heard of it or don't know your story, what's
there? Yes, so as you mentioned, I co-wrote it with Sarah Breen, who's one of my best friends, and we've been friends for, I think, about 18 years. We went to college together, we lived together in various places in Dublin. We're both from Ireland, both ended up in Dublin for college. And we can trace the origins of Aisling, who's the central character in these books, back to, we think, one hungover Saturday sitting under blankets in our flat in Stony Batter, which is a little part of Dublin. And we were wondering, like, who are the girls who keep the brown mascara industry going? That was like one of our first touchstones for this character. And we were like, you know those girls you see walking really fast to work, getting in their steps, building up their Weight Watchers points and carrying their lunch in like Brown Thomas, which is a fancy department store in Ireland, maybe the equivalent of Harrods or something here,
and
so you might buy something, a treat,
and keep the bag,
and then carry your lunch, and then you might also have your runners in the bag, and have your quarter and change under the desk in work. at, and we kept attributing all of these characteristics to this character, and we were like, what might her name be? And we were like, Aisling. It's a good, solid Irish name. It's a name that might be misspelled sometimes, which is something Aisling would hate.
Yeah. So, well, as I'm friends with, who's done the show as well, Aisling B.
Oh, yes, of course.
And she's in America at the moment, and they constantly like, welcome Aisling B.
Yeah.
Which, of course, you can understand why you'd go there, but yeah.
And as an owner of an Irish name myself, I get a lot of Emma or Emma's, and, you know, it's fine. But yeah, so Aisling was born, and this was back in about 2008, so it was the days before group texts or WhatsApp messages, or really group messaging of any kind. Yeah, it wasn't really a thing. So we were sharing this Aisling character with our friends, and we were all coming up with these amazing characteristics, like really specific stuff. One of my favourite things was like, Aisling has never dyed her hair because the sun brings out such a lovely natural blonde highlight. Like, it's mousy brown. That's the start and end of Aisling's hair is it's mousy brown, and she thinks it has a lovely natural kink. But so we were kind of afraid we were losing all of these kind of funny things Sarah and I were sending to each other. So I set up a Facebook page. It was the only way I could think of to really start a community. But it was only for our friends. It was only for me and Sarah and maybe four other people. And it just kind of grew organically, and people started joining, and we could trace back to when, you know, the first person joined who we didn't know, who wasn't a friend of a friend or didn't, but everyone just got it. And they were like, I know an Aisling. I am an Aisling.
Yeah.
I sit beside Aisling at work. I aspire to be Aisling. She's so organized. So that was 10 years ago. And fast forward, an Irish publisher approached us and said, we love this character. You know, you've made her into such a well-rounded human being.
Yeah.
Would you write a book? And Sarah and I have always wanted to work together, but we're incredibly lazy, so I've never managed. I've never managed to, you know, pull out the finger and get up off our arses and do it. So we said, yeah, but we'd like to do a novel. And I think they had thought that we would do kind of a gift compendium book that they would sell by a till at Christmas, and that would be that.
And I'd been approached for that sort of thing. And you're like, I'd like to write a three.
I would like,
a novel in the style of Chekhov. And they're like, we wanted something about emojis by the till.
Can we talk about our prose?
Yeah.
So Sarah and I said, look, if we're going to finally be able to work together, we want to be proud of it. Also, we didn't think anyone was going to read it. We just didn't want to make a show of ourselves in front of our mams. Yeah. And just, you know.
Classic.
Yeah, exactly. Aww. So we just, we said, can we do a novel? They said, give us a one-page synopsis. We, true to form, left it to the night before they wanted it, went to the pub, wrote the synopsis. And the rest is history. We wrote the book in about 4 months because, again, we left it too late.
You guys are amazing. This is my dream. This is how I write everything.
There are two of us, so you only have to write half a book each.
Yeah.
And we wrote a novel. Yeah, wow. And it has become a huge success.
Well, it's huge.
Yeah.
And you've got a screenplay deal as well.
Yeah, so we're currently working on the screenplay with Element Pictures, who are very well respected. Their probably biggest success to date has been with Room, which was big in the Oscars a few years ago, and Lenny Abramson directed it. So we're working with a producer and a development person there. So
Your life has like really changed then, hasn't it?
Yeah,
like,
we've been able to give up our jobs. We both worked in media. I was in radio and online journalism. Sarah was in magazines, but we've both been able to give up our, but this is our day job now, is writing books. We can't believe it. Like, we've turned messing into a career. We're just messers. Like, but yeah, it's been amazing. Like, we just can't believe it.
It's hard, isn't it, when it sounds like you slightly, well, I'm always projecting, but it sounds similar to what I have of like something that you find easy to do, which is like mucking about.
Yeah.
So you don't think, well, no one's going to pay me to do that. So the thing is easy. It's not important. It's not serious.
Yeah.
And then when the more you want, you realise you want to do it, and the more people start offering you money to do that thing, you're like, oh, but that's just the thing I did like at home without thinking.
It can be difficult to feel like you deserve it.
Oh, massively.
Like, I often feel a bit guilty. I'm like, oh, but like a lot of people, we've met so many people now on like kind of the literary circuit in Ireland and further afield. And people live and breathe, and they do their day jobs, and then they come home and they write for hours, and they strive. And Sarah and I have worked hard, don't get me wrong, but we did kind of have it handed to us.
Yeah.
But then I try and then pull it back and go, but we've developed this character for 10 years, and we put a lot of work into it.
And I think when you write comedy, you can't compare to writer-writers.
Yeah.
Because writer-writers sit in, you know, beautiful sheds in a wood crafting for 12 hours, and they say, I wake at 9 and I write until I can't stop. But comedy writers stare out the window, have a cup of tea, talk to their friends, go on Instagram, and then the joke is brewing.
Yeah, or make constant notes on your phone. That's what I do. I see something and I go, oh, there's a joke.
And it's like that sometimes it's hard, it's easy when like you do that to dismiss all that stuff. Yeah. Like, oh, I'm not working. It's like, no, it looks like I'm not working, but messing around is yeah. work. It's just also, I enjoy it.
We're just incredibly lucky. And yeah. then another level to it
and
as well.
Talented, Ema. And talented.
Thank you.
Not everyone can do that. That's yeah. what I think you have to realise when you write comedy. Because if it comes easy to you, like, yeah, but it's just chatting.
Yeah.
And then you're like, no, not everyone can do that.
Yeah.
Not everyone can chat and come up with noticing yeah. those things.
Sarah, my co-author, is good at kind of bringing it a bit back to that and going, oh, look at the amount of messages we get from people who've been yeah. really touched by our books. And, you know, look how many people have bought them. Look how many people have yeah. gone back out to buy the
yeah,
second one.
Yeah, if you were
one.
Just lucky and, yeah. like, chucking it out, you wouldn't be, you know, it wouldn't yeah. be as successful as it was. Four of your friends would have read it and gone, well done.
Yeah, you didn't make a show of yourself. Yeah, yeah. It's grand.
It's lovely. And yeah. I'll give it to my friend for Christmas. Yeah. Like, that's not what's happening.
Yeah.
So, obviously, Ema, that's not quite why you're here today. Mm-hmm. So, who are we remembering today?
We're remembering
life?
My dad.
Your dad. What was your dad's
yeah,
name?
Leslie.
Leslie
MacLeisett, yeah.
Leslie MacLeisett. It's yeah. a very grand name. I yeah. like that name. Yeah, yeah, it sounds glamorous.
Leslie Thomas Peter MacLeisett, I think, is his full name.
Oh, it's yeah. lovely.
So he died on the 25th of May, 2008.
So would you say, is that almost when you started doing this?
Yeah, it was around wow. the same time. Let me think. It was probably around the same time. Dad died when I was living in that flat with Sarah and our friend Kiva.
Wow.
And when we moved into that flat, he was, I think it was probably the summer before he died.
Wow.
And I remember I didn't even see the flat before he moved in because he was very ill around that time.
Yeah.
And the girls, we had been living in another terrible flat where nothing was plumbed properly. And there was like a kitchen extractor fan just bolted to the wall. And we were like, well, we have to move.
Yeah, yeah.
So I moved into this flat sight unseen and I just
wow.
trusted them with it and said, look, I can't be involved in this move. Will you help move my stuff? And they looked after it. So yeah, it was actually around the same time.
Wow, so you were obviously in need of some distraction and cheering up.
Yeah, I hadn't actually realised that, but it was around, I always say, oh, we started actually around 2008 and that's when Dad died.
Yeah,
so yeah.
I think it's very common for big stuff to happen or that once someone dies because it's like you have a hole.
Yeah.
You've got a hole to fill of like, they're not there, so what are you going to fill it with? Like,
yeah.
And it's, you know, some people fill it with bad things or other people go, I'm going to make myself laugh for a bit.
Yeah, I think we probably filled it with messing.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah.
I love that you call it messing.
Messing, yeah.
It's lovely.
We're just big messers.
That's so nice.
Dossers, as we say in Ireland.
Yeah. Pissing around
yeah,
as well.
Pissing around, yeah.
So what did he die of?
He died of metastatic lung cancer.
Okay.
So what I have since learned, having gone through lung cancer with a loved one, is it tends to start in the lung and then spread. And that's what ultimately kills the person.
Yeah.
So it spread to his brain.
Oh, God.
So he was diagnosed, I think, around 2005, 2006 with lung cancer.
Right, so it's quite a long journey.
He was sick. It was on and off for a long time.
Wow, that's hard.
He was diagnosed with lung cancer after he had actually, what's really heartbreaking is he had given up smoking. So it was caused by smoking.
Yeah,
years of
yeah.
smoking. He had given up smoking about 10 years previously.
Oh.
But it was too late,
yeah.
as is often the case with someone who's a very heavy smoker. And he would have started smoking probably in his early teens when it wasn't known that it was so bad for you.
Oh.
Then he was in the army where smoking would have been right.
They used to hand them out, didn't they?
Exactly,
right.
yeah. So, you know, I just feel really sorry for him. It wasn't, you know. But yeah, he was treated for the lung cancer and treated quite successfully. And then I learned kind of afterwards that you can't ever really treat lung cancer. Like it is... I think 95% of the time ultimately terminal.
Right, you can just try and extend.
But the longevity of the lifespan, you know, it's, you know, you can live for a long time, but it did ultimately spread to his brain and that's what killed him in the end.
Yeah.
Which was really sad because often brain tumours like take the person away from you. They're not really
the same.
Compos mentis for which was the case with Dad for the last few months of his life, definitely.
So when did it spread to his brain? Was that in 2008? Did it sort of...
No, that would have been around, I would say, early 2007. So
right.
he just started to display odd behavioural characteristics. Him and my mum were living at home, you know, in our family home, and he just was becoming... His behaviour changed. He was ratty and he was getting a bit dizzy and he just wasn't behaving.
Yeah.
You know, she was like, something's up here. And she went in for tests. And then it was, I remember the day she rang me. It was actually around the time we were moving. She rang me and said, you know, something's wrong with Dad. He's taken a spill. He's fallen in. He had fallen kind of over near the car and caused a dent in it or something.
Wow.
And she just got really worried, and so, you know, they went for tests and they confirmed, yes, it has spread to his brain. But, you know, again, they were very positive about treatment options and said, you know, chemotherapy is an option again, radiotherapy is, an, you know, even more of an option.
Wow. Yeah, they do it to try and shrink the tumour in the brain.
They try and shrink it. And actually surgery was an option for him as well. Wow. So he actually went through two brain surgeries.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was all in a very compact space of time. Yeah. Like, it's amazing what they were willing to put him through in order to make it. They obviously had a lot of hope for how long he could live.
Well, it's a difficulty with the medical world, which obviously they are amazing and they're trying to save someone, but there is that element of, I think when you are a family of a cancer sufferer, you sort of feel like, oh, they're fixing fixing a car, like they just have to take that bit out rather than like you said, no, he's going to die.
Yeah.
We're just working out if we do this, it might be longer.
Yeah, I remember when I realised he was always going to die and nobody told us.
Yeah.
I was really angry.
Oh, I think it's really hard.
Yeah.
Similar happened to my dad, that they offered him chemo. My mum was, she always says, she said, he's going to die. And they were like, no, we don't use that word, Mrs. Lloyd. And, you know, who knows? And she was like, I wish they'd said, yeah, he's going to die. We just don't quite know when.
Yeah.
Do you want him to go through this hideously painful and expensive for the NHS and debilitating for him treatment? Or do you want him just to fade away?
Just fade away, yeah.
And I think when you haven't encountered death in your unit, I think now I maybe you feel that I'd be very different to it now. But when it's your first time, you're like, just make him better. What can we do? What can we do?
Yeah, and isn't it great? Oh, he's doing better and we're getting good news. And like, you spend so much time in those consultants' offices, lovely, fragrant ladies with the shiny hair with the doctor's voices, and they're like, well, you're not doing very well today, are you, Leslie?
Yeah.
And you're just waiting for them to say, well, it's good news.
Yeah. And it's difficult. So I think part of, I'm sure there's a reason they don't spell it out, because part of your brain just can't take it.
Yeah.
So they do sort of need you to get your head around it over that process of treatment.
Yeah. And I suppose, like, 2 years out from him dying, or, you know, a year and a half, maybe they did think that they could give him another 5 years.
Yeah, you just don't know, do you?
But I feel like I would have liked to even know that the 5 years was an option.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think, maybe my mother could correct me on this, I don't think we were ever told, or I was ever told anyway, that he was dying until 6 weeks before he died. And at that stage, it was obvious to everyone that he was dying. And he died 6 weeks to the day that they gave
and
us
that. And then they said, this is it.
And that was at the point where he wasn't in the room. You know, that you get to the point where they're only telling, they're not telling the very sick person, they're saying, so this is what's ahead of you.
Wow.
I think I was kind of in denial. I was like, oh, maybe he'll rally.
Yeah.
Maybe he'll rally. I mean, it was never an option, really. He was...
It's really hard, isn't it? Because I can't get my head around how much of it is medical, the way of, like, always try and fix a body, and how much is a person being in denial and being like, oh, he's fine, he's fine.
Yeah.
Because you're giving him a medicine, and medicine makes people better. I think it's a real... I don't think it's enough to just blame doctors, because I think my family as well, it was so fast, and they were like, well, we're going to do chemo, and we were like, oh, okay, sure.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think we had the time to process, hang on a minute, what's happening here?
Yeah.
Why are you doing
ours
it?
Ours was so drawn out, I can't imagine the opposite, where it's so quick.
Yeah, yeah.
And you hear that a lot.
But I think drawn out is hard as well, because then you do probably think, oh, well, he's, you know, been a year now, and he's doing all right, and there's more hope in a way. In a way, the quickness, although it's awful, it's just done.
It's just done.
Like, oh, they're dead.
You're not constantly, you're not waiting, like, you know, we did a lot of there was a lot of watching of Dad. Probably mostly in between the first discovery of brain tumours and then discovery that they had come back, you know, more aggressively than ever. There was a lot of, you know, he couldn't do anything without being watched. I remember he wasn't allowed to drive after that first brain tumour, and that really killed him. He loved driving, it was a big part of his life.
It was a long
period of illness, but at the same time I feel like I can distill it down into like four or five events but if I look at it as a wider event, it was years of, you know, hellish hospital visits and him getting sick into a cardboard bowl after chemotherapy.
Yeah.
And
what they go through, the chemo, is really
terrific,
hard.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard as well, because part of your brain is like, well, why are they so sick if they're supposed to be making it better?
Yeah.
Like, this doesn't look good.
It's pure poison.
Yeah. And obviously there are people who have chemo and it does make it better. And you know, I have a friend at the moment that's being treated, and he had stage 4 bowel cancer, and he's had chemo, it's been awful, but he's coming through this treatment. You can see it's like, okay,
it does work. It works, you know, for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's obviously he's got a long, long road to go, but it's not, what I'm trying to say is, I'm not saying chemo is bad.
Yeah.
It works. But it's really hard to know, it's such a weird treatment that that's all you can do for cancer, just poison someone.
Yeah, although I do think even in the 12 years maybe since Dad had chemo, they've come on in leaps and bounds
in terms of how
they're able to manage people's side effects.
Because I'm 20 years in and it was really dreadful then.
I think they've put a lot of work into that, which is excellent.
Good work, guys.
But I mean, the chemo gave us Dad for another year or so that was in radiation as well.
So he had these operations and...
These were massive brain operations.
God, that must have been terrifying for you all.
Yeah, they happened quite quickly, I feel. Right. Like, it was just like, okay, well, we need to move fast and we need to move now. And then it's suddenly, they're cutting into his brain. That's...
It's not good. It's nothing you want to hear, is it? You don't want to hear the words cutting into brains.
Yeah, and the hospital where they do it in Dublin is Beaumont Hospital, which is a big old institution. Oh, and it's got those... kind of where the lino goes up the walls and there's that smell,
that
you know?
That smell of those old Victorian hospitals.
Yeah. And those big chairs that are impossible to move, which seems crazy. Like, one of the things that actually I've written about in the book, because I have written about this experience in her books, was that chairs in hospitals seem so impractical in a place where chair politics are so important. Like, there's always four people around a bed and there's only one chair. And it's like, well, who gets it? Who's the most important? Who has to sit on the edge of the bed on the scratchy blanket? Yeah. And there's always these big, massive armchairs you have to try and reef around beds. That's something a detail that really sticks at me is the bed and the chair politics.
And when they're in the four bed, you know, that is in like four beds on a ward. Yeah. And like, there's one person with like, they've got all the chairs because their family love them. And someone with no chairs because no one visits them. And you're like, this is horrible.
Or if you go into the hospital ward and somebody has more visitors than they're allowed and they're using all of the chair allocations.
you're
giving them the side eye going... Have four chairs there, do you?
Yeah, why do you need four chairs?
Good of yourselves.
Yeah, and those people look pretty young, actually. I think they could stand.
They actually look fine. You could actually be in the day room if you really thought about it.
Yeah, you could probably get up and walk. And actually, probably good for the circulation.
Loudly, are you okay there, Dad?
Yeah. Oh, my God. The passive aggressiveness of the hospital ward is really hard. My dad eventually got moved into a room by himself when he was dying. He was a room by himself. And I was really relieved because I found the ward very stressful.
Very stressful.
Yeah.
And I always imagined, you know, things like intensive care or people who are critically ill, you imagine Grey's Anatomy and a darkened ward with only spotlights and, you know, doctors manhandling each other in linen cupboards and then coming out fresh with romance. But no, a lot of critically ill people in a big, hot ward with not enough chairs and custard creams on side plates. Like, that's the reality of it.
They're doing the best they can. But it's important to break the Hollywood glamour of these situations.
Yeah.
It's often,
Dad actually, he ended up in a nursing home when he was dying because his brain tumours were so debilitating to him physically.
Wow.
It meant that we couldn't really look after him at home, even though we really, really wanted to. And we actually battled to look after him at home, but we had to try and source, you know, hoists and lifts and, you know, night nurses. And, you know, it's difficult.
It's difficult. I had this with my father-in-law. My father was a very tall man. And he had, I don't think it started in his brain, but he died of the, it spread to his brain. And my husband was trying to care for him at the end, and it was so hard because when someone's a big old man, they are heavy.
They're really heavy,
they are heavy. And my husband's a big guy as well, but it was like, I remember watching him struggle just to try and turn the bed and stuff, and it was like, I remember thinking, it's like trying to move a really old tree.
Yeah,
like, that is heavy. It's got a lot of life it's lived, and it's not really hard.
I think we really wanted to bring him home because we knew he wanted to be at home. Like, at that stage, he wasn't, this was probably around the time we were told he had about 6 weeks to live. And the little bit of communication he could do was, I want to go home. Want to go home. And we just couldn't do that for him.
It's so painful.
For us to get choked up. But and I don't think there was really space in a hospice. And also a hospice, I don't know, I don't have any experience of hospices because Dad went to a nursing home. But I think maybe they're for people who have a very short amount of time left or perhaps are in a lot of pain. Whereas we don't think really, which is the one blessing, we don't think Dad was in a lot of pain from what doctors were telling us, and if they thought he was, they were like pumping him full of morphine and whatever. You know, it wasn't making any difference at that stage. So they suggested a nursing home, which is where he went, and he was only 60, so it was very hard to see him in a facility just so full of people in their 80s and 90s who were there, you know, kind of naturally rather than because of illness. So that was difficult.
It's so hard, isn't it? Because I think sometimes when you're not in your 60s, which I'm not, it's like, oh, 60s is, you know, like, I think sometimes people don't realise that, like, that's the equivalent of being, like, a 19-year-old in a room with, like, you know, 45-year-old people. Like, you'd feel like, I'm a bit young for this. And 60 and you're some 80-year-old. It's like, it's like, oh, that, I'm a bit young for this.
Yeah, so that was tough. And again, when he went into the nursing home, he was still aware that he wasn't at home. And he still used to ask, you know, can I, you know, home was kind of one of the only words he used to say.
That must have been so
like
painful.
Like, it was awful. I remember battling with poor, you know, the Irish Cancer Society is, you know, the I think it's the Macmillan Trust here. It's
right,
a similar,
yes, okay,
similar body.
Yeah.
And they have amazing palliative care nurses.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting in the kind of courtyard outside the nursing home going, no, we really want to bring him home. And she was trying so hard to explain how difficult it would have been for us to look. And she was like, and there's so many physical things you would have to look after. It would be very difficult as a family member. And I was like, we don't care.
Yeah.
You know, and we started preparing a room at home to bring him home to. And it ended up being the room where we waked him because it was, you know, freshly painted.
It's so hard. It's so hard. And I think once they've gone into the facility, it's very hard to get them out.
Yeah, we managed to bring them home once from that nursing home. We had a neighbour who was a taxi driver, so had access to a wheelchair van. So he was able to organise to get Dad into a wheelchair. We managed to bring him home. And I remember my eldest brother said, you know where you are, Dad? And he said, home. And we were just, you know, at least, you know, at least he knew for that, you know, he had been home, but it was tough.
It's so hard.
Yeah.
It's so hard because I think there is, it's a bit like home birth, isn't it? It's like that, like, if, you know, I would have loved a home birth and I ended up with an extremely medical one and like I needed it. And I think it's like, it's lovely if you can die at home, but sometimes you just can't.
Yeah, you just
and
can't.
I think, of course you feel guilty, like we didn't do it. But
that was it. We felt guilty and we just felt like every second he was in that nursing home, he was hating it. But then as those weeks went on, he was less and less aware of where he was.
And also it's like there's so many times in life where your dad might have asked something, you would have been like, no, like, you know, I want to drive this car and I'm drunk. No, like, that's not okay. My job is, I love you, is to say no to that. And I think it's hard sometimes not to, to, you hear like, I'm denying you, rather than like, no, I'm protecting you by keeping you in this nursing home. And you are as vulnerable as a child. That's why we, you know, we protect children from sticking their fingers in plug sockets, even though they sometimes really want to. And he just,
He was so vulnerable and he was such a strong man all his life. Like I said, he was in the army. He looked after us all so well. Like he taught me and all my friends how to drive and he was so capable. Like he was, he used to fix everything in our house, always a little bit cack-handedly. So like it's still, a lot of his handiwork is still obvious in my mother's house. So, you know, if you want to turn on one of the big lights in the sitting room, you have to have another light in another room in the house. But it's just a classic dad touch. I mean, he just...
But it works, it works.
He could manage to fix everything eventually.
It's so hard when someone who's been strong and big and that force in your life is then just... Reduced is the wrong word, but it feels like, it feels like reduced to someone so vulnerable and you're having to do all the caring.
It's so helpless.
Yeah, and you're having to make those big decisions and you want them to say, it's fine, I'll fix it.
Yeah.
It's really hard.
Yeah.
So that last 6 weeks is in the nursing home. And were you with him when he died?
Yeah, yeah.
So were all the family around?
Yeah, all of, so I have two older brothers and my mom and then two of Dad's sisters were there as well.
Wow,
so,
the whole gang.
Yeah, in this small little nursing home. So we knew it was coming to the last days. And I don't know if you have experience of this, but what they do when people are dying is a lot of the time they will introduce a pump.
Yes.
So it's like they would pump a cocktail of drugs into the...
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if it is, but I have a feeling it's a form of euthanasia. It's just kind of...
I sort of think it is, but no one talks about it.
It's very high doses.
Like, no one's going to... We all know they're not going to survive that. And they say, like, they say it's pain relief. You're like, I think you're helping them go, but yeah, we're not allowed to say that because
exactly.
that sounds bad. But yeah. that is what's happening, which yeah. is good. You don't want them to drag it out in pain.
But at the same time, as soon as they started doing it, I was like, why didn't you do this 6 weeks ago?
Yeah.
I don't understand why you dragged it out. I mean, I know legally you're not allowed to kill somebody with a cocktail of drugs.
I guess that's it. It's like waiting for it to pass the point, isn't it?
Yeah, where they just... I remember one, whatever doctor was on call in the nursing home, coming in and looking into Dad's face and saying, I think he's in pain. I feel like he's wincing a bit. I think that was she just wanted to end it.
Yeah.
And I remember she brought us into the chapel in the nursing home, which was kind of one of the only private spaces, really.
Yeah.
And she explained this and she said, is that okay with you? And it was kind of a matter of fact. We were like, yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
And I remember Dad died on a Sunday night. And I remember I had tickets to go and see Bruce Springsteen in the RDS in Dublin on the Friday night. And I remember saying to one of the nurses in the nursing home, I was like, do you think? It sounds so irreverent now.
No, but I know, exactly.
Life goes on,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, do you think? I mean, is it going to be tonight? And she was like, go to your concert, love. Go to your concert. Have a great time. He'll still be here tomorrow.
Yeah. Good for her.
Yeah, and she was right. And I went to the concert and I had a great time. And
I hope you told him when you got back. I hope you said.
Yeah, I've been to Bruce Springsteen, Dad. You would have loved it. So those last few days were I kind of went off the rails a bit those last
of
few
course,
days.
Like, yeah.
We're from Kildare, which is a county south of Dublin.
Right.
So I was obviously living in Dublin. So I went out on the Saturday night before he died on the Sunday. And late that Saturday evening, you know, some of my friends were going out and I was like, I'm just going to drive to Dublin.
Yeah.
Like, what else am I going to do? Sit at home crying?
I know. And I think it's hard because everyone deals with it so differently.
Yeah.
And it would be fine to be sat at home crying, but it's equally fine to go out and be with life.
Yeah.
And I think that's what sometimes people who haven't been through it, they're like, oh my God.
Yeah, like, that's like even saying it now, hearing myself saying that I went out on the Saturday night, like it sounds so, you know, harsh of
a
thing to do.
But then it does it, because what it sounds like is that you went and lived.
Yeah.
And we talk about this a lot on the show, of like, when you're around someone who's dying, I don't know if you felt this, I felt like it was getting into me.
Yeah.
Like, I felt like it was, death was creeping into me.
Yeah.
And that's why I cracked jokes, I think, a lot of the time, or was irreverent about stuff, or denied a lot of things.
Yeah.
Because I was like, I feel like I'm dying.
Yeah.
And I think that laughter and that going out and being with friends is your survival bit of your brain going, you're not dead.
Yeah.
You have to remind yourself you're not dead, because you're just surrounded by someone who's just going.
And you have this kind of feeling of euphoria is the wrong word, but you know that feeling you get before a big event and it's kind of nervous anxiety?
Yeah.
It's that feeling, because everyone's treating you differently.
And you know shit's about to hit the fan.
Yeah.
This hasn't done it yet.
Yeah, and you're not in work and you're in this weird limbo of, I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, it's sort of like summer holiday feeling, but without any joy.
Yeah.
But you're like, oh, nothing is existing, but all my friends are at school and work and doing those things, and I'm sort of out. Yeah, you're in this weird bubble.
And you can't believe other people's lives are just going on as normal. And you're like, no, surely everybody is experiencing this.
Or they've done a lot of stuff and you've spent a day at a nursing home.
Yeah.
And you're like, you did all that. I was there all day doing nothing, but I wasn't doing nothing. I was with my dad. Yeah, it's really
it's weird.
I completely understand going out, seeing friends, laughing for a bit and having a break.
And they were close friends and they would have, you know, I don't know if they knew that he was dying, that, you know, it was his last hours, but, you know, they knew he was very sick.
Yeah.
And that I drove back to Kildare very early the following morning, probably irresponsibly, and painted our front door red because my mother wanted it painted for the funeral.
Wow.
And he hadn't even died, but it was just important to her, you know?
Just stuff that you just want
and
sorted.
Then he died that Sunday night. I think we had all of us been there in the nursing home during the day. Then we went to a nearby hotel for something to eat. And we got a call saying, you need to come back.
Oh.
And then, as you said, the irreverence, I remember when somebody's dying, it can take a very long time.
Yes. Oh,
the
my
last
God.
Last breaths come and go for hours.
Yeah, and you're like, is it now?
And I remember going, come on, Dad. Like, you're taking the piss now.
Because you're like, seriously? It's like a sketch, isn't it? You're like, this is starting to get funny.
Yeah, I was like, I wouldn't be surprised if he was just there going, well, no, I'm going to show these fuckers one last.
You think I'm gone? No, not yet.
But then he did eventually go about 10 o'clock, I think. And a huge relief.
Yeah.
Very sad, but just a huge relief as well.
You just
don't
want them to be... the thing is done. That's what you're all waiting for. And it's...
And it was baffling to me that it was so drawn out.
Yeah.
It's such a cliche to say, but like, you wouldn't do it to a dog.
I know, you wouldn't.
You wouldn't let a dog or an animal suffer like that.
And I find that amazing. Like, when you do go to a vet and they say, oh, we're going to put this dog down, you're like, oh. Because sometimes the dog's still like up and about looking at you. And you're like, are we going to murder this dog? And they're like, yeah, my God, this dog's in pain. It just can't tell you. And you're like, but when it comes to humans, you're like, I mean, isn't it? Why is that? It is a very weird thing. Like, get it. It's difficult.
It's like, we're going to let this man lie here, like, suffering for weeks and months.
Like you said, dogs would be, he put down months before that. Months before it got that bad.
It's very, it's a very odd. But it's a very odd way to do things. Yeah. But there isn't, I mean, I know some places do look at a way of getting around it.
Yeah, it's hard. It's really hard because, I agree. It's not like there's a simple alternative.
No.
Like, just take him out way before, guys. I understand. But it's when you're watching someone you love and you think, I know they're in pain. I know that this, it's really weird. I wonder what they did when, like, in super, super olden days when you didn't have hospitals, like, what did they just wait? Was like, what did they do?
I don't know.
God, this is why am I having this thought?
Like, sorry. Bring out your dead.
Did someone help you? Like, like the local lady in the village come round and
probably
like.
You just wouldn't have gotten to that point where you would have died a lot
sooner. I guess
sooner.
So, you would have died sooner because you wouldn't, like, you're right. You wouldn't have had chemo, you wouldn't have had anything extending it.
Yeah.
So that life extension is what we now have, but that obsession with that life extension can, I think, tip over into a slightly odd place.
Yeah.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
So you talked about waked him.
Yeah.
So just go into that for people who don't know how it's dealt with in Ireland.
So usually in Ireland, you will wake a person in their own home.
Right.
So the person dies and then they'll go to a funeral home to be prepared for burial and to be waked and, you know, all of whatever they do behind the closed doors in the funeral home.
Because you often have open caskets.
A lot of time you have an open casket. Yeah. Is that not?
No, it's not here? That unusual. It's not that usual here. I think it might used to be, but I guess definitely from the sort of repressed English Church of England style, it's definitely like, well, I don't think we want to look at the body. Thank you. And you don't have a wake. You have what's sometimes called a wake, which is the party afterwards.
Okay, yeah.
When you say waked him, some people do, obviously, but it's more, I would say, Church of England, very common that they go to the funeral home, you don't see them, they're in a box, they go behind that curtain, or they go in the ground, or they go cremated, and then you go to the pub and have dry sandwiches.
Yeah.
Like, they're not there for that bit.
Yeah, we have the dry sandwiches as well, but we also have a party before that.
Yeah, yeah.
So the waking is most often in the person's home, and it will usually be either for a day or 2 days before the funeral, depending on family wishes or how many people they're expecting to come and pay their respects. So,
and the coffin is there in the home?
The coffin is in the home, and it usually stays in the home for at least one night.
Wow.
And then there's a removal.
Right.
So sorry, at the wake, people come, pay their respects. You can go into the room where the coffin is. You can touch the dead person's hands. You can say a prayer. There might be a decade of the rosary, depending on the religious, wants and wills of the people who are there. And then usually there will be a removal the evening before the funerals. The removal is where you remove the body from the home and bring it to the church.
And who does the removal?
Who physically does the funeral?
Funeral,
the funeral home,
right.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
So they'll bring one of those big long black hearses. Right. And so that's, I'm pretty sure that's what we did for Dad. And then what I found really difficult is the body stays overnight in the church alone.
Oh, wow.
I think if you want, you can choose to stay, or someone can stay with them.
It's so fascinating how different people deal with it. Is anyone there in the church?
No.
That's mad.
Yeah, it's mad,
so,
isn't it?
So as an English person, I'm like, wow.
Yeah, it's mad. Now, you can do the removal the morning of the funeral, right. And some people, and I think maybe that's maybe becoming more common.
That's quite Church of England, yeah. Like, it gets picked up from the funeral directors in the morning.
Yeah.
Then they normally drive to your house, you get picked up in all these funeral cars, and then you go to the church.
Yeah, the fancy limousines, yeah.
Yeah, but it's sort of kept in the fridge until it goes, and it's only in the church, really, for, like, the
ceremony.
Also,
I think the gap between death and funeral is much longer here in the UK.
It's
quick in Ireland. It's usually 3 days.
Sometimes it's like 2 weeks because you've got organized, you've got to book the church and get the funeral director, so they're just sitting in that fridge.
I think usually in Ireland, because the whispering network is so close, the priest already knows, he's right prepared, the prayers of the faithful have been assigned, that auntie's going to bring up the offertory procession, and you know, this is all for a Catholic a Catholic.
So was it hard
service?
For you knowing he was going to be there by himself?
That was really hard. It was very difficult. It's lonely, but in his final few months, he became a little bit more religious than he had been. So, you know, we were a kind of middling Catholic family. You know, we went to Mass every Sunday until I was about 14 and put the foot down and said, no, I'm not going anymore. My dad went occasionally, but as he got sicker and sicker, he, I think, was leaning on religion a bit more. And asked to see a priest a few times and prayed a bit. And, you know, so I kind of tried to reconcile that with the fact that he was in the church. And my mother would be, again, kind of middling religious, and it might have been important to her. So, but I had been dreading the funeral. Yeah. I knew it was coming for months. I was so anxious about it. I was so afraid of being so upset in front of people.
Yeah.
I had kind of decided I was going to do a eulogy because I felt like he deserved it. You know, masses are very just often staid kind of. The priest wouldn't have known Dad that well. So I just wanted to say nice things about him, but I was dreading it. I was dreading it nearly more than him dying, if that makes sense.
But it's almost the acceptance of him dying.
Yeah.
You standing there talking about him in the past tense is almost more real than, this person who's been sick for ages is in a nursing home and I know they've been sick for years. Yeah. So that's,
And showing emotions to people, again, a very Irish thing to just be like, no, we're all grand, put on the kettle.
Well, that's what we definitely have in common with. It's like, it's fine, they were a wonderful person. So did you do the eulogy?
Yeah.
Did you write it?
I wrote it.
You wrote it.
I actually started writing it weeks beforehand and had a few different drafts.
Yeah.
Just things I wanted to include. He had been in the army. That was a big part of his life. I wanted to mention that. And him and my mom were best friends. And, you know, we'd had this great dog growing up. And, you know, wanted to mention that. Just all these little things. And also, Dad loved music. And we wanted to play one of his favourite songs in the church. So we actually had to battle against the will of the priest, who said that it wasn't appropriate.
What was the song?
It was Forever in Blue Jeans by Neil Diamond.
Oh, that's not... That's not like... I don't know, like something really rude or something.
I think the evening before the funeral in our house, maybe at the before the removal, I think I had said, so Father, whatever his name was, we'd like to play a bit of music at the end of the ceremony. Yeah. If that's okay, we'll bring a CD player, it'll all be fine. And he was asking what the song was, and we told him, and he was like, that might not be appropriate. And I think I was just like, well, do you know what, you can go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
Because...
Did you say that to a priest? Because I'd love to have seen that.
I don't know if I actually said that, but maybe my face said
it. Your face must
have said it. So I enlisted one of my really good friends, Deirdre. I said, well, there's going to be a CD player near where you're sitting. So when I give the nod at the end of the eulogy, I want you to press play.
Oh, this is amazing. So you stealth. You were like, sure, Father, sure, babes.
Yeah, I was like, yeah, okay, well, we'll see what happens.
I love this. This is proper like... You pay it, babes. I'm gonna do what I want.
I remember him sitting in his throne on the altar with his lips pursed while my little nieces danced in the aisle like money talks. And every time I hear the opening strains of that song, I'm just, it catches in my throat. Yeah. I'm like, oh.
That I've talked about this before. The end song at my dad's funeral was this Frank Zappa song, Peaches mm-hmm. and Regalia, which luckily is a really obscure Frank Zappa, so I don't hear it very often.
Okay.
But that's one of my really lasting memories of that funeral. I don't really remember much. I remember bits, but I remember it was in this amazing church in the City of London, and I think it's a really old church, like, you know, in the 1600s it was built or something. And it's probably not true. It's old. I was thinking someone's going to tweet me.
Oldest Tay.
And I remember just this instrumental music just filling this huge, yeah. like, gothic church. And I remember feeling really like, wow.
Yeah.
This is a really great way to have him here and have him present. And I would have hated to be told, you know, we had some hymns as well and stuff, yeah. but it was like, that's not the person. The person,
exactly,
you know,
yeah.
the person didn't live and die as a priest. Then there might be other music. And yeah. even if they did live and die as a priest, they might have really liked Neil Diamond.
Yeah, yeah. It's such a nice memory I have, yeah. and the relief. Yeah. As that song played, I was like, I've done it. All I have to get through now is the burial. And then that's it done. I can have a big glass of wine and yeah, so did sleep for 1,000 years.
Were you emotional in the eulogy?
Yeah.
But a little. Of course.
A little, but I held it together yeah. enough not to completely. I remember because Dad was in the army, but he had retired 20 years previously. Like yeah. in Ireland, you need to serve 21 years in the army and then you can retire. So wow. he had joined at 17.
Wow.
So was able to leave, you know, quite yeah. young. But some of his old army buddies had come in their uniforms, had brought an Irish flag and draped it over the coffin and wow. carried the coffin in and out.
Wow.
Which was just, you know, because he wasn't an active serviceman, he didn't have yeah. an army funeral, but that he would have loved that.
Yeah.
Like the ceremony of it, the importance of it, he would have just loved that. And these were men also in their 60s struggling under the weight of a coffin with my brothers. Like it was...
Yeah.
But then, the Neil Diamond was just...
Yeah, perfect.
Perfect. And yeah. it starts with that very soft guitar chords. It's like, do, do, do.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah,
it's,
yeah.
And then it builds and builds. And my little nieces at the time were, you know, 5, 6, yeah. kind of... They didn't know what was going on. So they were twirling their skirts and dancing. And it was just the perfect send-off, yeah. I think.
Yeah, it's why the fuck not?
Yeah, yeah.
Why the fuck not? So then you know, your dad has died.
Yeah.
What was your grieving process like? Did you sit in your room and cry? I mean, obviously you didn't, because you then immediately started creating a comedy character.
Yeah. Not really. I guess because I knew it was coming.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I probably didn't deal with it for a long time. I actually only started going to therapy.
Wow.
In the past 6 months.
Right,
and it's
wow.
been 10 years since Dad
wow.
died.
18 years yeah, it took me. Yeah. yeah. I think it's not uncommon to need time to process it all.
Yeah, I think I was kind of afraid that I was going to go to therapy and she was just going to bring everything back to, well, your dad died and that's yeah. why this happened.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, that just seems like an easy way out, you know?
Yeah. But sometimes you don't give yourself that kindness.
Yeah.
I have this all the time. Like, my therapist, every single thing, she's like, we come back to it, it's like, oh, it's about my dad.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, God, this is so boring. And then she's like, but something really, it's a big trauma. Why yeah. why wouldn't it have affected you?
Yeah.
And I, for years, was like, I don't want to be defined by it.
Yeah.
And now I am absolutely defined
yeah.
by it. I mean, I'm
yeah.
doing this fucking podcast. And it took me so long to let myself
yeah.
go, oh, yeah, that's probably why that happened.
Yeah. My therapist says that as well. Like, I have this thing where I go, but why am I making such a big deal out of this?
Mm.
The fact that Dad died, everyone loses parents. Everyone goes through
yeah.
this. And she was like, not everyone goes through, like,
yeah.
some people go through their lives with very, very little trauma.
Yeah.
And, you know, she was like, you have been through significant trauma throughout your life. And, you know, this is why you cope with things today
yeah.
in these ways. And, you know, it's hard to accept that. And she's
yeah.
like, you're too hard on yourself.
Yeah, I think you're too hard
yeah.
on yourself. I do, because it's like, some people, you know, yeah, lose their parents in their sleep when they're 95.
Yeah.
And I think also, and I know I always bang on about birth and death and it pisses people off, but if somebody had a baby, no one would be like, my God, your child is 10, get over it.
Yeah.
Like, so what? You've got a kid, like, send him out, give him a job. We wouldn't do that. We'd be like, oh, you're a mum for life.
Yeah.
And you've lost your dad for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
that's, why is that any different? Like,
I know,
it's a
yeah.
huge thing. They're half of who you are. They were your, they're the reason you exist. Of course them dying makes everything in the world completely different.
And I feel like it changed my life completely. Yeah. And I think I would have had a very different life.
Yeah.
Very different life.
What did it give you, do you think, then?
What did it give me? Probably stronger connection to my family. Like, we were, a fine family, but probably wouldn't have been much for kind of hugging and, you know, hanging out together an awful lot. And in the years after he died, we definitely did that a lot. I remember being really sad that he had died before I was friends with him, if that makes sense. Mm. So he died when I was 27. And even though that's quite old.
Well, yeah, but it's all relative.
I had just finished my degree, you know. I was kind of just about ready to start my proper adult life.
Yeah.
And then he got sick when I was in college.
Yeah.
And I felt like I never got to have that period of time where we were friends.
Yeah.
You know, we fought all like cats and dogs when I was a teenager, carried on a bit into my 20s, just, usual.
Yeah,
dad, daughter.
Oh, God, yeah.
But, I felt really sad that I'd missed out on the chance of being his friend.
Yeah.
As opposed to his daughter.
It's hard, isn't it, as well? Because there's no way you can go back in time and tell that person.
Yeah.
You should hang out with him. Because you just can't. And actually, that's the natural process.
Yeah.
And, I wouldn't say to anyone, I would say to someone, like, appreciate your dad, but equally, you can't force it.
You can't force it.
Right, we're going to sit down and become friends because you might die. Like, it doesn't work like that.
No, it doesn't.
But yeah, there's
But I think we would have been good friends.
Yeah.
And I know that he had a nice plan for his third act of his life would have been, I would imagine, a lot of travelling. My mom was a teacher and she retired just before he got sick.
Yeah.
They had a great life planned out for themselves.
Yeah, it's really hard.
And it's really sad, yeah. So.
And is it sad? It's just sad. Yeah. And it's hard to... I've just found that so hard for so many years to just let it be sad and not let it be like, no, I don't want it. Like, I don't want that. I don't want to be sad. Who wants to be sad?
I spend a lot of my time avoiding being sad.
Yes, same.
Like,
same. If you work in
even
comedy,
when I was coming here to talk to you today, I was like, oh, I feel like I might get sad.
Well, that's what I had for years. I was like, which is why I would talk about it privately. But the podcast, like, even now, I sometimes think, why did you do it? Because you don't like being sad. But somehow I think for me, it's in control of being sad. Because it's like, well, I'm choosing how I talk about it and no one can surprise me.
Yeah.
But in my family, my mum's from a very working class background. And I maybe it's unfair, but I do feel there's a slight working class thing of like, just get on with it. Wash yourself down. Worst things happen at sea.
Yeah.
Like that, all that attitude of like, don't be sad. Don't be sad.
Yeah.
The worst thing you can do is be sad, which is like why we probably both work in comedy.
Yeah.
But probably. Also why we're in therapy to deal with our sadness.
Yeah. Yeah. And why I wrote about, this is a bit of a spoiler, but wrote about, my dad's illness and death in a comedy book rather than, talking to my mother about it or,
How was it writing about it? Did you find it cathartic or?
I did. Mm. It kind of happened by accident,
Really?
As I said, Sarah and I got this book deal kind of handed to us.
Yeah.
We were approached, so it wasn't like we had written anything.
Yes.
And went to a publisher with 40,000 words and said, you want us to write the other half or whatever. Yeah. So we had these, 80, 90,000 words to fill. And we had the character, but we didn't have much more than that. So they say, write what you know. So, we started fleshing it out and it was like, maybe daddy gets sick. And then it was like, maybe daddy gets really sick. So, what happened to my dad was he got sick, he got better, he got sick, he got a bit better, he got sick and he died. And that's kind of the what happens in the book. Reading, I actually read back over some of it last night because I hadn't read the book in a while. Yeah. And reading back over it, I was like, did I write this?
Wow.
I don't. It's so concise and clear about what it was like in those months in the hospital.
Because it was so fresh for you.
So, yeah. Well, yeah, it was. But it's just, like, I didn't tell my family that I was putting Dad's story into the book.
How did that go down?
It went down well, I think.
Oh, good. Yeah.
So, like, when I told my mum and me and Sarah writing a book, and she was like, what's this, book in inverted commas? She was very sceptical. She was like,
sure.
And then I gave up my job.
She didn't like that, right? Yeah.
And she was like, apparently they're writing a book. I knew the second she got the book that she would know that, there were huge parts of both her and Dad in it.
Yeah.
And there are. You know, Dad, we always had cats and dogs at home, and Dad would always be like, oh, that bloody cat, that feckin' cat. He loved it. Like, absolutely loved it. If it went missing, he was out, you know, searching the hedges. And that's a big thing with, you know, Aisling's dad in the book. It's always the bloody cat, capital B, capital C. Yeah, he's always sitting in his chair. So little things like that, I knew Mam would recognise instantly.
Of course, yeah.
You know, and the first hints of Daddy's illness in the book come quite early. Mm. So I knew that she would know. That was, you know, largely based on him. And she just said that he would have been very proud of me. And I remember she said to a friend of mine at our book launch, you know, I think she needed to write this. I think, you know, she wouldn't say it directly to
me. I love it's such a mum thing to say to someone else. And then your friend is like, your mum
said this.
And
then my friend reported it back. Yeah. Like, I didn't set out to write Dad's story in that book. It just happened. And
I find that so fascinating, though, that you created a really funny girl when you were not feeling funny.
Yeah.
So it's almost like you gave yourself this little person that could be silly and funny and you could notice all this stuff about her, so you were not having to look, oh, I'm really sad and all this.
Yeah.
And then you made what happened to you happen to her.
Yeah.
And I think that's a real, that's like a writer's way of dealing with something.
Yeah.
It's like, I can't, which to me, that's what I mean, it's funny. It's like, you are a writer, because your first instinct was like, I'm going to put this over here.
Yeah.
In the way that, like, I would say I'm like almost a professional talker, because the way I've started processing is that I have started recording myself talking to people about it. And when people say, oh, like, oh, you know, did you practice talking to people? It's like, what do you mean?
No, I'm just talking.
That's what I do all my life, is I've been talking about it. And I think that's fascinating. You gave... And you were able to control it and step back from it and look at it.
Yeah, and I felt really sorry for Aisling, you know, when it happened to her.
In a way that you haven't been to yourself, maybe. Yeah.
And one of the most rewarding things about the whole success of our books and everything has been the sheer number of people who've contacted us, and in particular who've contacted us about the Daddy storyline.
Yeah,
so many people have gone, I felt like you were in the hospital with me.
Wow.
How did you know that about the custard creams? How did you know that about the slippers under the... You know, one thing used to kill me about Dad was the slippers, the good slippers. Slippers lying uselessly under the bed that he was never going to put on again.
But they bought in in case he needs them.
And in his going out pajamas. But that's been so rewarding, is hearing from people who it's really helped. And we've been accused by so many people, they're like, I thought it was a funny book, I was crying on the bus.
Well, that's like this podcast as well. It's like, oh, it's comedy, and someone's like, I was crying. I'm like, but isn't that life? Isn't life like you are laughing and you are crying?
Yeah.
And that's what I look for in, sound like a wanker now, but like what I always look for in art is things that move me and make me smile as well.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm not someone who, I don't like comedy where I'm just laughing. Like I always want more, because I'm like, but that's not my experience.
Yeah.
And I think if you've been through something as traumatic as this, you do go, well, that's not what life is. It's harder than that.
Yeah.
And how great to mix the two. Like, and still be laughing. It's, you know, like, it's a hilarious book, it's a hilarious character, to still be having those lighter moments.
Yeah.
But yeah, people, they feel like they've been tricked because you made them think about death.
Yeah.
And they don't want to think about death.
Exactly. And they just weren't expecting to cry.
Yeah.
It's quite funny, the number of people who were like, I was on the train and suddenly I was crying.
I get a lot of those. But now people, they'll tweet about it and they'll go, oh, you should listen to Grief Class, but be careful if you're listening on the train.
Yeah.
Like, you might start crying. It comes forewarned with it.
Aisling should come with a warning on the cover.
Because it's true, all the stuff around it is, it's so funny. Yeah. Perhaps they need a little sticker saying, make
And then in
tears.
The second book, obviously, it's kind of the aftermath of Daddy's death and approaching that first Christmas and...
Wow.
Missing them, and you know, it's all of that was drawn on from personal experience as well.
How incredible that you've been able to draw on all this stuff and then give it to this girl and watch her deal with it. I think that's amazing, Ema.
It's been you asked earlier what did you get from his death, and probably that's what it has been. I'm only sad that he's not around to see it.
I know, like, that's the shit bit, isn't it? I know exactly how you feel, because you go, oh, this thing's doing well and it's really connecting with people, and I'm really proud that it's connecting with people, because I went through a traumatic experience where you died, so you can never see this. That's why this exists, because if my dad hadn't died, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. And I have Instagrammed about this, actually. I got invited to a fundraiser for PCUK, Pancreatic Cancer UK, that's what my dad died of. And Suggs from Madness had organised it, because his sister-in-law died of pancreatic cancer, and they throw this amazing gig every year. They raise loads of money, and they invited me to come, and I was so excited, and I was, you know, like a foot away from Suggs singing
amazing.
It Must Be Love.
Oh, like, amazing.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
And I just had that moment where I was like, I'm only here because you're dead.
Yeah.
And it just, I started crying in the middle of, like, everyone was like, it must be love. And they were all like losing their shit because Suggs is literally in front of you singing it. And I thought, that's life for me. All yeah. these moments are so wonderful and at the same time, absolutely wrapped up in sadness.
Yeah.
But now I just try and let them rather than be like, kill the sadness.
Yeah, I'm
like,
everything's fine.
Yeah. I just kind of, and you must have had that with this book. Every time you get offered, you know, a screenplay or yeah. something new and exciting, you're like, yeah, it exists because they died.
Yeah. Sarah and I were on The Late Late Show, which is Ireland's biggest chat show. You know, everyone watches it on a Friday night. And that would have been the pinnacle of Dad's pride. Yeah. Like, she's on The Late Late. Jesus, Alice, set the record if she's on The Late Late. But, you know, he's not here, so.
Yeah. And I think what I try and take comfort from is that I know what he would have said about it.
Yeah.
And I think some people don't. And I try and take, that's what I try and take, that I know he would have said, wow, record it, I'm really proud.
Oh, he would have been down in the village telling anyone who'd listen, you know?
And I think that's all, I've said this to someone, it's like, all you can do, all you can hope your parents do is love you so much that when they're gone, you know what they would have said and they would have still loved you. That's kind of, because everyone, that, like you said, they're all going to die.
Yeah.
And if they did that, it sounds like he did a really good job of loving you.
Yeah, yeah. He was always very proud, so.
Yeah. Well, Ema, thank you so much for coming to talk to me about
thank you.
Leslie. Full name, what was the full
Leslie
name?
Leslie Thomas Peter McLeister.
I love it. Yeah. I absolutely love it. Yeah, yeah, thank you. Sounds like a real gent.
Thank you for having me. It's been very cathartic to talk about.
Thank you.
You can follow Ema on Twitter at Ema the Screamer, and Ema is spelled E-M-E-R. Her two books, Oh My God, What a Complete Aisling, and The Importance of Being Aisling, are out in paperback now. Do buy them, they're extremely funny, and do follow on Twitter as well. She is a very, very, very funny lady and worth the social media follow. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast, and you can email thegriefcast@gmail.com. Music was provided by The Glue Ensemble, and the show was edited by Kate Holland with thanks to Whistledown Studios. And remember, you are not alone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.